I'm Macy Chan.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, December the 30th. And as we look back on our year in review at The Pulse here on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, we're looking at some of the big themes and stories of this last year, and especially how COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the most vulnerable and marginalized in our community. One of the groups that we've had most commonly on our program this year have been substance users and drug user community organizers from all kinds of groups, organizations, and medical fields. Today, we're going to sample a few of the interviews from across that spectrum as the pandemic unfolded. Some of these aired earlier in the pandemic and some more recently. But all told together, the pattern emerged of a pandemic that unequally impacted our city and our community in the downtown east side, and disproportionately magnified the social ills and inequalities that our society has. We're going to start out with a more recent interview from Sarah Blythe at the Overdose Prevention Society, talking about what the holidays look like and mean inside that life-saving harm reduction facility, which was created by and for the community. Our first interview today was originally broadcast on December the 1st. Hello, Sarah. Great to have you here on The Pulse.
Thank you. Thank you. And
we've been covering a lot of issues around overdose prevention side and decriminalization and the war on drugs since our program launched in March, but really great to have you on the show with us directly.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time that you guys are having me on.
Yeah. So before we talk about this sort of historic motion at City Council, I just wanted to start off just talking about what it's like at the overdose prevention site right now. I know things were pretty wild over the course of this pandemic. I wondered, where are things at now?
Yeah, so right now, there was a time when the first wave of the pandemic happened, and a lot of people sort of went back to their homes or back to the alleys. They didn't really know what to do, and now we're starting to see people again, because now the message is you need to be together no matter what, because drug users will most likely die of an overdose and not of COVID. Just because of what the statistics are saying. So keeping people together, making sure they're safe, making sure they're wearing masks, making sure they're careful, with their interactions, following protocols, that sort of thing. It makes it a lot more challenging, but also at the same time, keeping people safe from COVID and also safe from overdoses is really important. So we'll be there as we are open, probably all year long through the Christmas holidays and everything else. So,
yeah, we were just talking to Guy Felicella yesterday in our program, and he was sort of worried about the holidays coming up because it's a particularly stressful time that can bring up a lot of trauma for people.
Yeah, it always is. Thankfully, we were able to fundraise some funds to have a Santa and some elves and, some Christmas stuff going on. Some people from the community will be the elves and Santa, and we're going to have lights and Christmas presents and trees and things like that. So we're going to try and make it as fun as possible. But yeah, it's a tough time for a lot of people. It's not my favorite time of year either. So, I mean, not everybody enjoys it. It's the time where trauma did happen in some families. It's not always the most fun time of year for everyone, but it is for some people. It's kind of like Valentine's Day. Not everybody enjoys it.
Yes. And for many people, that can sometimes lead to relapses or re-upping your dose or whatever it needs to take to get through it. And unfortunately, that puts one in danger these days.
Yeah. And I mean, there's going to be no family occasions anyway right now, really. I mean, your really small circle bubble of family, it will be able to be together, and it's going to be tough. It's tough on people who have children. It's tough on children who don't get to see their parents. It's tough on a lot of people. So, I don't know if it'll be any tougher this year. I think because there's less services, it'll probably be a lot tougher this year. There's a lot of services that can't be open because of COVID, and a lot of services have shut down. So, people aren't going to get the Christmas that they normally do down in the downtown east side.
Well, I'm really glad that you've got a Santa and some elves and putting up some decorations, I guess.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I mean, we know how to make Christmas fun. We have fun down here. I enjoy Christmas in the downtown east side. It's always good. We make, you know, bring some sort of potluck situation together and hot. This year we're going to be a little bit more careful because of COVID. So it's going to be COVID-friendly Santas that you keep your distance from with a mask on, and Santa will be wearing a beard that's probably a mask or something like that. I don't know.
So some creative. Yeah. With the second wave, have you noticed a change in the patterns of who's visiting or how much?
Not really. I mean, there was a, you know, an immediate, you know, as soon as COVID hit, there was an immediate, you know, reduction in coming to our site. But now we're starting to, you know, look to where we were. So I think people are seeing that, you know, there is a safe way to come to Overdosed sites. Have a big outdoor area where people can outdoors with a tent and be away, you know, 8 by 8 by 8 away from people, so they, you know, they can safely use away from other folks and be, you know, if something happens, we can help them out in a safe manner. So, you know, we've obviously had to adjust. In the first part of the COVID crisis, we didn't, you know, you don't really know exactly. Okay, this has never happened before. This is totally terrible, and but, you know, we're going to have to adjust to it. So, you know, as you adjust, things get better, right? So it's things have improved and they're getting better.
One thing that I know has changed is there were a lot of workshops offered last year and, you know, that were really ramping up to get more people trained in how to use naloxone. I'm wondering, is there any way that people can still do that? I know that pharmacies give that out, but the trainings were kind of pivotal for a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, we've considered doing some videos. There have been videos in the past. It might be actually good, now that I think of it, just to do something online, like an online video webinar on how to use Narcan. That would be quite simple, as long as other people had a chance to get the Narcan kits. But, you know, there's ways to train people. We've been asked. You know, there's a business street had to deal with an overdose, and they didn't have Narcan, and they called the ambulance, and it was quite scary for them. So I've just been contacted that group to do some training, and there's a safe way to do it in small groups, and we continue to do that as we can, as people ask.
Well, I wanted to talk about the city council resolution, and it's particularly interesting to talk to you, not just being on the front lines as a co-founder of the overdose prevention site, but you were in city politics. You were an elected official with the park board before that. What does this mean to you?
Well, for me and the folks that I work with on the front lines, the decriminalization just means that more protection for people in the downtown east side, and folks not being harassed by police officers for having drugs, small amounts of drugs. You know, it's gotten a lot better, but at the end of the day, it can be used by police to add on these charges to other things to make things worse for people. And if they end up with a lot of charges, it's really hard to pull your life back together. So, I mean, at the end of the day, just, you know, having this as a real thing, having a law in place that criminalizes people and the ability to use it, some police will use it regardless because it's the law. But you have to really get not the law in order for police really to understand that that's just not their job to do. Changing the law will be the thing that makes, you know, makes the big difference, I think. And then... argument about what is what. It's just the law. That's how it is. So it's important for folks that have been criminalized so much in their lives. In a lot of ways, it's just a health crisis, and people need, you know, they need safe access to medication. They need other things. They need rehab if they want it. They need you know, things that can help them, you know, make their lives more comfortable and better, just like everyone else. Because basically, with people not overdosing, people with safe supply, their lives will improve by a lot that we've seen, and that will improve the lives of other people as well. People won't have to steal, they won't get be, you know, in the ambulance. They'll be, you know, there's a lot of happen steps, which I think governments are obviously afraid to do because of the stigma, right? So, and they think, feel that public perception should be on it. But, you know, really, at the end of the day, if they do the right thing, good things are going to happen for everyone. And they should, ones at all levels of government, to be able to explain it to the public what needs to be done.
Now, I wanted to ask you if you could put your former elected municipal official hat on and say, how are you surprised by this going through? I mean, it was unanimous. It seems to have been quite a groundswell.
There was a lot of work done by folks from the community, and the city did, you know, asked, what do you want as a community, drug users? What do you need that will help you? And this was one of the priorities. So, you know, if you ask, that's what they wanted. And so that's listening to the community. And so, that, you know, I think it takes guts to be able to move forward on these kind of things and help people. And it will take that kind of guts, all three levels of government, know how we'll ever do it.
You were just saying you were hopeful about this.
Yeah, I'm hopeful about this. I think that all levels of government really need to work together. And if you know, for the right reasons, you know, when they do the right things for the right reason to help people with this crisis, it's going to turn out good for everyone in the end. So, there, you know, it might be challenging, but I think they'll find that they get a lot of support, and a lot of people really want to see the end of this. It's not a partisan issue, where, as in, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, people are dying from every political stripe at a really large level, 5 people a day. So, you know, parents are losing their children. People are losing their friends and family. It's very terrible times for people. And really, you know, not enough's been done. And it's terrible. You know, today I looked on Facebook and I saw 2 other people that I knew that have passed away. And to be honest, it's just totally preventable if we would just, you know, really step it up. At a certain point, the government needs to be held responsible if they don't do enough, really.
Now, the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, since you have experience at the municipal level, is just how little power cities actually have. Like, once again, this is another motion, although historic, that urges the federal government to do something. And I guess that's just the nature of the game.
Yeah, I mean, from what I hear, you know, some are just sort of virtue signaling, you know, just to sort of say this is where we stand, although we can't do anything about it. But I feel like in talking to people, that there has been some groundwork done on this, and it's not just that. So I feel like, you know, that the federal government has had conversations with the city. I don't exactly know what, but I feel like that the groundwork's been done here. So I feel confident that something will be done. And, you know, I mean, I've put forward letters that I knew that would not really produce anything in the past on park board myself. So just to try and push people into doing something, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But this I think has a bit more support than that. So fingers crossed. I'm really hoping that the feds come through for us on this. They should, because it really should be ashamed of themselves with how many people died. And they got to do something, that, you know, something big has to happen here.
And as we've heard on our program, it's the current system is not working and is deadly. So whatever might go wrong with any potential change or attempt at this, it's, you know, the status quo is pretty horrible.
Well, at the end of the day, this is what drug users have asked. Those are the folks that are dying. So at the end of the day, you know, what you're doing, what the public has asked you to do, that are being most affected by this. So there's really, you know, it's time to just help them out and try to do something right.
and take their word for what needs to be done. And I think that good things will happen for the future. And, you know, the war on drugs obviously totally failed, and people are dying at alarming rates. They're being put in jail. They're getting criminal records where, you know, they're stuck for their life. Once you get a criminal record, you can't travel. You can't get a job doing certain things. And it really limits your life. And then what do you have to do? You have drug dealing. You have, you know, things that you might not necessarily want to do. So this can really help people have other choices in life. And I think that that's really a big thing for being able to change your life. I've helped people get rid of their criminal records in the past, and it's not very easy. And so it's really important to be able to move past some of these things, because all of these things make lives more difficult, right? If you got a criminal record, you got health issues, you got other things, you know, getting a job, and it just everything becomes sort of more difficult and unattainable, and including housing, right? So you need all of the things to kind of go right to be able to contribute.
What do you make of Prime Minister Trudeau's recent statements that decriminalization is not a silver bullet, and that's why he's not moved ahead with that so far?
Well, I mean, I don't think it is a silver bullet. I don't think anyone thinks that it's a silver bullet. I mean, we need safe supply, we need housing, we need rehabilitation on demand for people. So, I mean, in some ways he's right about that, but we need all of the things. It's not one way to fix it, right? There's a lot of things that are wrong. So, but it's a step forward, and I think we have to chip away at all of the components and get to a point where, you know, we're doing a lot more for people. So, but I don't think it's an excuse. It's not like all or nothing, right? I mean, you have to do some things, and this is something that he can do. So he needs to start doing stuff, because otherwise other people are going to die, and it'll come down to him. And it's not necessarily whether he gets elected or not. It's just about how do you sleep at night with all these people dying under your watch. So, and I mean, government failure to deal with this has really made it so that more people are dying at all levels of government. So at a certain point, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be able to sleep at night thinking that I could do more. And I'm hoping that that rings true with, you know, everyone else.
I wanted to ask about Safe Supply program that BC brought in at the start of the pandemic and has modified a few times. It looks like there's some more changes coming, potentially expanding the list of drugs on that list if they can get them supplied. What are you hearing on the ground in terms of, are people accessing this program? Are they finding it easy to get what they need?
You know, to be honest, everything's kind of a slow start. I'd like to see things go a lot faster than they are going. I mean, I am seeing people access medication, but you know, at the end of the day, with COVID and everything's kind of feels like things have slowed down even before they got started. So you know, I'd like to see really everybody know how to get Safe Supply, where to go, demand it from their doctors, have their doctors prescribe, get the training that's needed. You know, in some ways I'm sort of tired of hearing about it, and I just want to see something happen very drastic so that we don't have to deal with people dying all the time.
What needs to improve about the program?
Just making sure that it's available to everyone and in a very simple, easy way, just as available to people as using drugs, you know, or buying drugs on the street. You know, it's got to be that simple. So, There's got to be a way to roll it out that it's very simple, very easy, and getting, you know, more people able to do it.
And presumably more drugs that people are actually using, because we don't right now have heroin in there.
Yeah, heroin in there. I mean, ideally there'd be fentanyl in there at this point as well, a safe supply of that. I mean, people may frown on that a little bit, but the thing is that people are using fentanyl now, and, you know, if you can take fentanyl safely if you were able to know how much you're taking. So, it like, getting people off of this stuff that they don't know what it is, it's totally garbage in a lot of ways sometimes. It's in all drugs, and
And it's kind of terrifying, really.
Well, we just had these 7 overdoses at a party in the West End just from MDMA.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So we're seeing that when you're testing drugs, like we test drugs at our overdose prevention site. So we're seeing the different things that are in drugs, and sometimes it's okay. And thankfully, you know, we see something come in, and then, you know, if the dealer's sitting there in the alley, we can march out there and say, what the hell is this? Get rid of it. It's going to kill people, right? So testing your drugs is really important. No matter what drug it is, you never know what it is. Unless you've gotten it tested with a spectrometer, so making sure you do that. Never use alone. I mean, these people didn't die because they were together. And in some ways, the thing that you've got to do for the overdose crisis is the opposite of what you do in the COVID crisis, which is be together. So if you're going to do drugs, be together and make sure that you're with someone and that you stagger using. You test the drugs if you can. One person uses once, the next person uses after that, that kind of thing. So, and, you know, these people lived because they were together and someone was able to call 911. And so that's good. If they used alone, they might be all dead but right now.
What's with the Lifeguard app? I've heard about this being used more and more.
Yeah, there's a Be Safe app and a Lifeguard app. And you can use while someone's online with you. And then, you know, if you don't hear from them, then you can call 911, which is a great thing. I mean, there's nothing better than having a person with Narcan beside you or even using an overdose prevention site like what we have, because we can see a person overdosing immediately, deal with the issue and get them some Narcan and oxygen and all the things that they need.
Without delay, because that can cause long-term problems.
Yeah, delay can cause death. It can cause long-term problems. You know, minutes are so important when it comes to breathing, obviously, right? So you can die within minutes. So, I mean, obviously you do whatever you know, it's better to do that than not do anything. It's better to be at an overdose prevention site. It's better to have someone with you with Narcan. There's all kinds of things that you can do so that you don't die. Using alone at home because you just don't feel like you don't want to see someone or you just are tired and you don't think about it too much is not a good idea. That's really where people are dying. People in bathrooms, at parties, you know, things like that. Just terrible situations. I've heard about a lot of things that I really, it's just sad to hear one story after another from mothers about how their children died. And you know, hearing about young people. You know, my son had a friend that died that was when he was 15 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just, how do you even explain that to young people? It's not good. You know, it's terrible. So, it is affecting young people. It really is. When we were young, or when I was young, probably older than you, but, when I was young, I mean, you could kind of experiment and have fun and get wasted and like do a line of something or whatever and wake up in the morning and whatever. It was just crazy times, right? But you can't do that anymore. It's just not like that anymore with drugs, right?
Before we let you go, Sarah, is there anything else you wanted to let our listeners know in the downtown east side?
Just be safe. You know, if you're at Christmas time, you're feeling lonely and you're using drugs, you can always come and see us, and we're around for people, and we can help you with resources. We've become kind of a one-stop shop because there's a lot of places closed. We have food donations and things like that.
And that was Sarah Blythe, founder of the Overdose Prevention Site in the downtown east side. That interview originally aired on December 1st. You're listening to a Year in Review episode of The Pulse here on CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Next up, we're going to hear from Laura Shaver. This was an interview I did with the BC Association of People on Opioid Maintenance Activists back on June the 10th. Laura is leading a class action lawsuit that's been filed against the makers of methadone and methadose, and we discuss the role of big pharmaceutical corporations in the opioid poisoning crisis.
You know, I didn't know if we were going to be able to get to this point, but since I've actually already been the plaintiff in a winning class action. I'm very excited. I'm very scared, but I'm also, you know, it's been a long fight, and it's time for the public to see that what we've been saying, you know, since 2014, you know, is not only true, but that, you know, there's been a lot of people that should still be alive that I believe are dead because of the methadone-methadose switch.
Could you walk us through what happened? When I had a show on Co-op 5 years ago, we had Garth and you on to talk about methadose. And
yep.
From the first day it was prescribed, people said, this is not working.
No. So I guess I was one of the unlucky ones that actually my prescription for methadone was up on February 1st. So I actually started methadose on February 1st, 2014. Within 4 to 6 days, I guess, of that, I was no longer an abstinent heroin user to an injection heroin user again to this day.
Because I'm just reading the lawsuit here.
So a second grade medication that did not work, that didn't last as long. And, you know, people that had been stable on, you know, an opiate replacement for many years either relapsed or went up in their methadone scripts because of the switch. Actually, I think there are different research papers that say 75 to 80% of the people that were switched in BC either went up in their scripts expecting that that would make it last longer, or just went right back to using illicit heroin.
I'm reading the statement of claim to the BC Supreme Court, and certainly we don't need an academic study to see what you experienced in withdrawal during methadose. Headaches,
no.
Inability to concentrate, distress. Tell us a little bit what happened. You get the new dose.
So you get the new dose, and you feel almost like you are, like you have an extreme pneumonia, but maybe even worse, because you know that that there's more to come. You know that there's withdrawal. You know that, you know, sometimes there's inability to think properly. You don't have control of your body. You know, we went from having a group of the BCAPOM, so the British Columbia Association, now called Opiate Maintenance, from people of 35 to meetings that had like 6 people, because people were out having to hustle again for drugs when they were stable on a prescription drug that they had no choice in being switched to, and still over to this day have to get a special exemption to even be on. There was the one pharmaceutical
methadone to prevent withdrawal.
Yes, exactly. It's full function is to stop withdrawal. And what it did was increase withdrawal, because people who hadn't had withdrawal in years all of a sudden were going into withdrawal from a prescription medication when they weren't even using illicit drugs.
I wanted to go back to the 2 episodes you did with Crackdown that were so good, Change in Tolerance. And one was about the original change, and then the second was a follow-up where you actually uncovered some very disturbing information about the drug company. Tell us about that.
So, you know, they gave us false information. They didn't give proper information on people's bodies could react, how, you know, its different functions. We also uncovered somewhat of a, I don't know what you would call it, a payoff, or where there was a donation given in an undisclosed amount of money to the College of Pharmacists. You know, when Mallinckrodt Pharmaceuticals got exclusive distribution rights to methadose in BC, which meant that no longer could any pharmacy or doctor prescribe methadone unless they were not able to attain methadose, which of course we know wasn't the case. So they, you know, they came, they actually even sent representatives in person to a meeting with the BCAPOM board to tell us that there would be no change, that people who were on methadone when switched to methadose would feel no change at all, that we would feel no withdrawal, there would be no withdrawal symptoms, there would be that everything would be exactly the same except for the consistency or the milligram was different. They just would give it to you instead of taking, say, 100 milligrams of the liquid, it would only be 10 milligrams, but it would still be the same effect as if you were taking the other drug, which is absolutely not the case. And even now, you know, Health Canada is sending out a questionnaire asking, you know, for opiate replacement consumers to tell them how, if they've ever changed or been a switch, how it affected them. In Saskatchewan, they're about to change to methadose, and they have written this thing in saying that, you know, it should be at the patient's disclosure if they want to, because of the how we could be destabilized from it. And we tried to do this how many years ago? We even offered as a board to be guinea pigs for methadose so that we could see how our bodies reacted to it before 18,000 people switched to it. And they told us no, because it wasn't covered by Plan C yet.
And that's the PharmaCare plan that funds drugs in the province.
You betcha. And that's the province of British Columbia that also didn't do their own investigation properly either, because they should have found out this information before we did.
So tell me a little bit, for listeners who don't know, when you had to go out looking for street drugs again after having been on methadone, what were the consequences of this? I understand that you and other people you know overdosed because of this change.
So since 2014, I've had 8 overdoses. The majority of them have been at home with my partner, which, thank goodness, there has been 2 of them at Van Du. Thank God for people being here also as well, or else, you know, so that's essentially 8 times that I was dead because I used an illicit drug. I believe stemming from the methadone change, because until we started methadone, I was not using illicit heroin. So I wouldn't have seen any need to have been using the tainted fentanyl today. And my best friend, as well as my used to be my president of the British Columbia Association of People on Opiate Maintenance, is now dead.
Sure, he's quick.
And I believe it stems directly from the methadone switch.
That's Cherise Quaiton.
Yes. We know, there's still 11 people a day in Canada dying from a fentanyl overdose, and that between 75% to 80% of the people that were on the prescription withdrawal management program either relapsed or went back, then that's a lot of people that I believe the province and Mallinckrodt are responsible for being dead or for disrupting their lives to never to be the same.
Like, who is this Mallinckrodt? I'd never heard of them, but they're based in the States, but they moved to Ireland for tax reasons. Mallinckrodt is definitely a name that sounds a little bit like a, I don't know, from a movie or something.
It sure does. It reminds me a little bit of like dwarfs, you know, like almost creepy to just think about how I sat in a room with those people that were executives telling me that, don't worry, it'll be the same. You, like, we have blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't. And we even asked right from the beginning, please let us see, do you understand what part of our lives you're responsible for? And that you made this change. And I believe that, you know, nobody would have known even about any of this if there wasn't, you know, drug users or people as myself to say things or do things, like, because the people would just go on as, oh, you're just drug seeking. And nobody would ever even question a huge pharmaceutical company or the province of British Columbia for being irresponsible with our lives.
In February, just of this year, the company had to pay over $1.6 billion US to American states over the opioid crisis. And it turns out that Mallinckrodt's subsidiary supplied 30 billion oxycodone pills and were pushing the opioid addiction epidemic there. That was worth 80 pills for every person in the US.
That's right.
So now they have a role in this methadose, and with the provincial government giving them essentially an exclusive deal. It just must feel like you're up against the, you know, Goliath here.
Well, they are some, I know I wrote it even probably specifically like this, they are some huge heavy hitters. Like, to be that to have that much power and to have done so much damage and still be around is I don't get it. I don't understand how can that happen. And that's because partially because there's a Trump, because Trump is in control, and he believes that half the people that those pills were given to should have taken them anyways.
Mm.
But I, you know what? I don't care how big they were. I went against the province before, and I'm not scared to do it now. And especially with the evidence that there is, I have nothing to tell but the truth. I have nothing to lose. They already put me to someplace I never thought I would go.
I wanted to read a statement from Mallinckrodt about their accusation that they're fueling opioid crisis and overdoses. They said that they don't produce more opioids than the annual limit set by the law, that they have been at the forefront of preventing prescription drug abuse and have invested millions of dollars into opioid abuse programs. What do you say to that?
What a crock of crap. I wish I could swear. Because what do you mean? You've just fueled the hugest drug fentanyl crisis in the world. In life. What did you just have to pay out because of something you did in one state and now into another country? Because, you know, now that BC has launched, you know, a lawsuit, and I hope to God that we win it, that all of Canada is going to, and I hope that other places in the world that have something to do with Mallinckrodt will see or investigate into things that they know are going wrong.
It must feel very unjust to think about Cherise and the people you know who you think are related to the methadose switch. What
I think unjust is almost not, that's not enough. I've lost so many people, including my bestest friend in the whole world, who was at the forefront of this fight to an overdose crisis that is stemmed from Mallinckrodt Pharmaceuticals. No matter what they say, it's their fault. They are responsible. They gave false information. They almost, in a sense, they paid somebody off to let this be, that only they were the ones to prescribe a medication. You know, if you're really into fueling and stemming to stop overdoses, then you know that one of the biggest things we need are choices and not just one.
Before she passed last spring, did Cherise talk to you about the switch to methadose? Do you remember anything she said about
Cherise
her formulation?
Cherise sat beside me in every single meeting.
Mm-hmm.
She was never the same. You could see in pictures, if you look on Facebook pages or watch Bandu, you'll see that from the switch until the day she died, she deteriorated. You could see her weight go down, her face changed, even the way she talked, the way she acted. She was never the same. And yes, she talked about it. She wanted to have this case just as bad as I did.
You think she would be a plaintiff with you if she was still
I think
alive?
She would be the plaintiff.
Do you feel like you're carrying on in her memory, that you want to fight this battle for her sake?
Oh, definitely. Almost specifically for Cherise, so that she knows that her, what she was fighting for was the right thing to do, and that we don't deserve to be treated the way that we've been treated.
What gives you hope, Laura, when you see these fights that seem like you're up against a billion-dollar company and up against governments? What is it that keeps you strong?
The fact that I'm still alive, because it's the drug users that have saved my life. It's not it's not companies like Mallinckrodt, because or else I wouldn't be going against them. They would be beside me and not against me. They're here to make our lives better, not make them worse. And so if they can't do it, then I will.
We were talking earlier about how it is to be, you know, your life was saved because a few times you were at Bandu. And I know that you've been such a leader in BC APOM. I understand meetings are starting again.
That which?
The meetings, the post after the COVID that you're
going to be. Yeah, so we haven't been able, well, BC APOM is probably one of the only groups that's actually still kept having some meetings. Mm-hmm. We haven't been able to have them all because the meetings we have had, we've held outside. Because of the COVID, Bandu has not been able to have its drop-in center open, and our injection spaces, we can only be at half capacity. So, which is really scary that, you know, there are people that are outside that not only are we in the middle of, you know, a pandemic, we're also still in the middle of a fentanyl overdose crisis where safe supply is not still an option that is open widely enough to everybody who needs it.
Well, I mean, with the safe supply, I remember when they rolled it out and I saw that, you know, prescription heroin or cocaine or other stimulants weren't really on there. It's all pharmaceuticals. It seemed like it was a bit limited. What's your experience?
It's extremely limited. I know most people that use Rock don't want to have anything to do with what they're giving as a stimulant replacement because it's not cocaine. You don't have the same actions. You don't taking a pill for a smoking addiction is not the same thing. Part of the cocaine and crack addiction is the actual use and the actual like production of getting your pipe ready. The same with crystal meth use. You know, it is a good start, but what we actually need is prescription cocaine and prescription heroin. And until then, there's still going to be many deaths on top of a pandemic.
What are people saying, or what's the experience you've heard about people actually accessing safe supply?
So, myself, it's actually been, it has been a positive change in my life. You know, I'm not using nearly as much illicit heroin, but for a lot of people, they're not even being able to access it. They can't access the methadone or the methadose that they want, let alone asking their doctor for a safe supply for their illicit drug use.
And I heard that it's different, depends on which doctor you go to. If you go to the PHS clinic, then you're going to get it, but other doctors might be hesitant.
Yes, extremely, especially in small places. I've had a lot of different outreach calls that I've done with different cities that are smaller where they're having an extreme hard time because not only, you know, is it hard to go against their doctors, it's like everybody in town finds out all of a sudden that you're an illicit drug user.
So there's a stigma aspect.
Yes, a huge stigma.
Did you ever go back on the methadone, the original formulation?
No. Because it was, I think, just May 25th, 2019, we were introduced to Methadol D by the College of Pharmacists, which in actual I did switch to, which has been a godsend to me. That is a lot closer to the old methadone formulation than the methadose ever was.
If there's anyone who is on a methadone or was on the switch to methadose, how can they support your lawsuit or get involved in BCAPOM?
So I think they just need to keep their ears open that somewhere here down the line, we're going to need some affidavits. We're going to need other personal stories. And we just need people believing in themselves that they deserve to live and that never to not to let anybody, no matter how $1 billion pharmaceuticals they are, have the choice to tell you what kind of medication you know that your body needs.
Mm. What's your biggest hope?
Is that the old methadone formulation can be, you know, that can be accessed by anybody who wants it, but that it sets precedence for other things that, you know, there needs to be peer involvement in all different medication switches. And just to show that, you know, just because they're a pharmaceutical company doesn't mean that we're just a bunch of drug users who don't deserve to have a life. And I hope that maybe there's some money in it.
To fuel the work you're doing.
Why not? For sure. At least.
Well, I really appreciate your time, Laura. Thank you so much for talking.
You're welcome. Talk to you later.
Good luck. Stay healthy.
And that was Laura Shaver with the BC Association of People on Opioid Maintenance, talking about her class action lawsuit that is ongoing against the maker of methadone and methadose. We originally aired that broadcast on June the 10th. And as mentioned, this is a year in review episode, looking back over a tumultuous 2020 of some of our most memorable shows. Today's review is of different interviews we've done about the opioid epidemic during COVID-19. Here on The Pulse on CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio, 100.5 FM. Find all of our previous shows at thepulse.cooperadio.org. And for the last interview of today, we're going to look in the medical field and what's recommended for people who use drugs and those who support them despite regulations asking people to self-isolate and to not gather socially during COVID-19, experts say that could cost lives and likely has. And you should never use drugs alone, but either use a supervised consumption facility or overdose prevention site, or use with a buddy. But trying to keep a 2-meter distance and wearing masks if possible. Here's Dr. Brian Conway with the Vancouver Infectious Diseases Center. This interview first aired on The Pulse on September the 1st. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Pulse, Dr. Conway.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We have lots of listeners in the neighborhood and people who are or know drug users. Can you kind of say a little more about what symptoms of dope sickness might be similar to COVID and what people should do if they have them and they don't think it's from a withdrawal?
Sure. So if people have muscle aches, have shakes, chills, might even be a little bit short of breath, I think all of these things would prompt individuals to think that they are withdrawing if they are active users and to seek out some drugs to deal with these symptoms rather than thinking of it as COVID and having to seek out a healthcare provider to assess this and get tested.
Can fever also be part of a withdrawal symptom?
Well, they would present mainly with shaking chills. Mm. That could be associated or interpreted as fever. People who have fevers will often have shaking chills. So I think that's where the overlap occurs.
One of the theories that, you know, I've seen bantered around a bit, because as you mentioned, there are some homeless communities in the States which did have major outbreaks. And there is that big study from, I think, Boston, from a shelter that had a significant outbreak. Is this potentially because of the amount of preparation and concern for the downtown east side to get all the organizations on board with measures to prevent it?
I think the big difference between Canada and the United States is the presence of uncontrolled community-based spread that was present in the United States and the inability to test each and every individual who may have been infected. And if a positive result is obtained, to engage in proper contact tracing. I think one of the things that we did better than anyone else in Canada in general, British Columbia in particular, was to find these cases and to have the contact tracing in place so that even if there was community-based transmission, which we had to a very, very limited extent, if at all, we were able to limit the impact of each case. And that's an important feature in limiting spread into neighborhoods like Vancouver's inner city.
However, you are researching this question about the downtown east side's seeming resistance to this. Are there any areas you're pursuing? And tell me about your research. Is there a possibility this could be some other explanation?
Well, prior to us having to live with the COVID pandemic, we had developed a system called community pop-up clinics, where we go to specific neighborhood locations on the downtown east side and beyond that inner city residents would often utilize to get services, be it emergency lodging, food, access to other services, showers, laundry, and the like. And we would have a medical clinic on the spot to try and create a re-engagement in necessary health care that was lacking for many of these individuals. This was obviously cut off with the COVID pandemic as all of these locations closed. As they have reopened over the past 6 weeks or so, we have started doing these pop-up clinics again to test individuals' knowledge about COVID, to make sure they understand what the symptoms of COVID are, how it is spread, and how to seek care for it if this is necessary, to fill in the parts of their care that had been interrupted as part of the shutdowns that were mandated by public health measures for the COVID pandemic, and also to try and set up a system where we will be able to provide influenza vaccination in a more broad and universal way when it becomes available in the fall, since that'll be an important part of the ongoing response to the COVID pandemic, and we'll also set up a structure whereby we could administer COVID vaccines to this very population when such vaccines become available. And the fact that their healthcare services got cut off has led to an unfortunate increase in the number of opioid-related deaths that have occurred in the past several months. We've had over 170 deaths on a monthly basis for May, June, and July, which sets a record for the opioid overdose pandemic that we have been facing, this public health emergency we've been facing for a little over 4 years.
Truly heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's hard. We have had significantly more opioid overdose deaths than COVID-related deaths. So I think this is something that we need to pay attention to going forward.
And of course, those opioid-related deaths are very clearly related to some aspect of the measures to combat or prevent COVID-19. So a bit of collateral damage in a sense.
Absolutely. This is collateral damage. We have prevented these individuals from interacting with their healthcare providers in a way that they had enjoyed before the COVID pandemic, and that includes access to the pharmacies. We have prevented them from accessing emergency healthcare for complications of opioid use, and we've told people to personally and socially distance, which has increased the prevalence, the likelihood of individuals choosing to use alone, which is a very risky behavior in itself. So we need to design strategies.
Early in the pandemic, I think on this show in particular, we had talked to the BCCSU and some folks at the Portland Hotel Society's clinic about any possible ways we could do a harm reduction kind of recommendations for COVID, because obviously staying away from other people was going to be extremely dangerous. I think everyone saw this coming pretty early, that piece of advice would not apply to this neighborhood in the same way.
No, you're quite right. And we need to design something COVID friendly that will restore the type of interactions that's useful and necessary to control the opioid pandemic.
Now, how much of a pivot is it for your pop-up clinics to get ready for a potential vaccine administration and to actually help people with potential COVID symptoms or concerns from what you used to do, which is, I think, mostly HIV and Hep C, correct?
Yes, and basically we're able to expand the program quite nicely because all of this fits in. We're able to do COVID antibody testing. We have to adapt the timing of the clinics because we have to correspond to the specific time frame where individuals are allowed to use the services, which in some cases is between 7 and 9 in the morning. We have to see less people, ensure that personal distancing is maintained, and we have to use protective equipment to make sure that we meet all public health guidelines. But we, to date, have been received with open arms.
Our station is right beside the PHS clinic, right down on Columbia Street near Hastings, and I know they have been operating throughout the clinic, and you can see how well prepared they are. They have someone greeting people at the kind of antechamber with the full plastic covering and face mask and eye shield and inside, but with a lot of welcoming too. You can just sort of see people are treated with respect, and you have to put a little extra compassion in the medical field when your face is covered completely.
Well, I think that just being there is important, making sure that this partnership gets reestablished. In some cases, the partnership was not pursued as well as it potentially could have been. And that's totally understandable because the COVID pandemic is generational. But we have to rebuild these bridges for the benefit of the population we choose to serve.
When you mean partnership, you're kind of talking about the therapeutic alliance between a doctor and patient?
To me, it's about engagement, it's about multidisciplinarity, and it's about durability. So it's taking someone and making sure that they understand, as we try to understand and act out, that this is a partnership. This is something about an engagement between myself and the individual I'm serving. It is multidisciplinary. It's meeting all of their needs at the same time, and we have to be in it for the long run. And I think these are the features that characterize the most successful programs, including those of PHS and what we aspire to do on a daily basis.
How can people get connected to you? And is this for anybody with health concerns, or is this are people who potentially are concerned about COVID, should they go somewhere else?
Well, I think that it's there are testing sites for COVID that are available through the provincial authorities. And I think these need to be the main places to get tested for COVID. At our outreach events that are widely advertised and held once or twice a week on the downtown east side, people can walk in according to the rules and regulations of the host institution that limits access, limits the number of people. But I think we're slowly going to be building up to meet the need as broadly as we can. And again, respecting the principles of engagement, multidisciplinarity, and durability.
What have we learned that we didn't know at the start? And what should people know about the actual risks of the long-term impacts of this virus?
Well, we're still learning, since this pandemic is still young in its evolution. We know that older people are at higher risk of becoming severely ill or potentially dying from the infection. In younger people, we're seeing inflammatory consequences of the infection that may be debilitating and may be permanent. And in some cases, we're seeing prolonged disease that is affecting people's ability to breathe mainly in the long term. So we're still defining the spectrum of disease going forward.
And is there anything before we close that you'd like to remind the listeners in the Downtown East Side and Downtown Vancouver in general about how we prevent this most effectively based on what we've learned?
This disease spreads indoors in individuals who are very close to each other for an extended period of time, 15 minutes or more. If you can design your life however precarious or vulnerable it is to avoid these kinds of situations, this is going to be the most important part of responding to the COVID pandemic. And we understand that the measures that we put in place, we as healthcare providers, public health, the public health officials and others, have led to an increase in the opioid-related mortality. Our condolences go out to the individuals and their families who have been affected. And we are working very hard to try and find a solution that will help keep the rate of COVID low and address this worsening of the pandemic as soon as we can.
I guess the message of keep 2 meters distance, don't be indoors for 15 minutes, but also don't use alone if you're going to use.
And if you're going to use, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up and reminding me of the most important message that relates to the opioid pandemic. Most people who die have used alone. So please use with a buddy.
Thank you so much, Dr. Conway. Great to talk to you. And I look forward to seeing the results of your research. And let's hope that the second wave passes us by or at least is contained.
Let's go out there and be safe.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. And that was Dr. Brian Conway with the Vancouver Infectious Diseases Center. And with that interview originally aired on September the 1st. Well, that wraps up our year in the review episode for today on December the 30th. Thank you so much for listening. Find us at thepulse.cooperadio.org. And we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy new year.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.